From the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Rendezvous with History, a podcast that captures the drama of presidential decision-making. Dr. Anthony Eames sits down with prominent scholars and leading citizens to bring to life what happens in the White House and how it shapes the world.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Well, welcome to Rendezvous with History, and I'm joined today by Stephanie Freeman, historian at the U.S. Department of State, and author of Dreams for a Decade, right here, International Nuclear Abolitionism and the End of the Cold War, available on Amazon and anywhere you might procure your books. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
So, you have a little bit of a disclaimer to share with us to make sure that it's your words and not the views of the U.S. Department of State, right?
Yes, I will go ahead and give my disclaimer that the views expressed here are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of State or the U.S. government. And I will add that this book was published actually before I entered government service.
Good. Okay. So we got the awkward government statement in the way.
Yes.
Time in this town. Now to the meat of your book. We've had a lot of books lately on the end of the Cold War.
Yes.
Nuclear fear, the arms race. And your book is one of the best in this area and really brings us back to the 1980s, this pitch moment of nuclear anxiety. And various calls for eliminating nuclear weapons, abolishing nuclear weapons altogether. You set up two kind of distinct lines,
yes,
of nuclear abolitionism, if you will, something that's altogether different than what we see in most other books about the end of the Cold War.
Yes.
Can you lay out those lines of abolitionism? Who are the main characters? Who are the leading proponents? And why were they so different?
Sure, yes. So I argue that Reagan and grassroots anti-nuclear activists in the United States and Western Europe really shared this dream of a world without nuclear weapons, but had very different strategies for how to achieve it. So Reagan pursues, you know, what he calls the peace through strength strategy. Reagan wants to modernize U.S. nuclear forces in order to give the Soviets an incentive to engage in meaningful nuclear arms reduction, because Reagan is convinced that the Soviets were ahead in the nuclear arms race. So he thinks we need to modernize U.S. nuclear forces. This will give the Soviets an incentive to take arms reduction negotiations seriously. Now, by contrast, you know, many activists in the United States really pushed for a nuclear freeze. They wanted, you know, a bilateral U.S.-Soviet freeze on the testing, production, and deployment of new nuclear weapons and their delivery vehicles. They thought, you know, this should be the first step on the path to disarmament. You know, ideally, they wanted a freeze before arms reduction negotiations began so that these talks would not be overtaken by new weapons development. Meanwhile, you have activists in Western Europe, many of whom are calling for the withdrawal of nuclear weapons from Europe as kind of a first step toward disarmament, you know, certainly as a kind of a precursor to talks on complete nuclear disarmament. So you can see that these are very different strategies, Reagan's strategy and the activist strategy. And Reagan and the activists actually have quite an adversarial relationship with one another because of these different strategies, because each view the other strategy really as dangerous and ineffectual.
And disingenuous in a way.
Exactly, right? Yes. So the grassroots activists, you know, they think peace through strength, Reagan's strategy makes no sense. You know, they think if Reagan really wants to reduce nuclear weapons, why is he trying to modernize nuclear weapons? This could increase the risk of nuclear war. You know, this costs a lot of money. They thought the fact that Reagan was even talking about nuclear modernization, you know, this in their minds showed that he was, you know, not serious about disarmament. So they certainly didn't think Reagan was their ally. Reagan, on the other hand, he didn't think the activists were his ally either. He was very concerned as their strategies became more popular among ordinary people in the United States and Europe. You know, certainly among members of Congress. He worried, you know, if a freeze, for example, is imposed, this would lock the U.S. into a position of nuclear inferiority vis-a-vis the Soviets. This would, you know, take away the Soviets' incentive to negotiate arms reduction. So this made him very anxious. He felt like he needed to try to take steps in the early 1980s to prove that his peace through strength strategy was the way to go. And so I show in the book that this, you know, pressure from these activists makes him accelerate his timetable for beginning INF and START talks, reinforces his personal desire to have bold negotiating proposals in INF and START talks. Also, later prompts him to make changes to some of these proposals and even to unveil the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, in 1983. You know, he hopes this could be kind of a new element to his disarmament strategy that would make it more viable and more popular at the expense of the freeze movement in the U.S. in particular.
So I like that you pointed out SDI for two reasons. One, shameless promotion here, the Reagan Library and Museum will be launching a new exhibit on Star Wars and SDI in the near future. But second, it's one of those moments. It's one of those moments in the 1980s where nuclear anxiety really comes to the front of pop culture.
Yes.
And really kind of etches itself into the public consciousness. Can you give us a few more of those moments where it seems like the whole world, or at least all of America, is thinking about nuclear war?
Yes. So you see, I mean, really in the book I show that kind of you see nuclear anxiety really sort of increasing in Europe before the United States. So really kind of beginning in the late 1970s, as the nuclear arms race is ramping up, as U.S.-Soviet detente is collapsing, certainly you see ordinary people in Europe fearful that, like, what if the United States or the Soviet Union are heading towards a nuclear conflict? And they felt like, you know, they were going to be the battleground. They worried that Europe was going to be the battleground, you know, for a nuclear conflict. In the U.S., I mean, certainly during Reagan's first term in office, when he makes a statement about it in October 1981, about it being theoretically possible for the superpowers to fight a nuclear war that would be limited to Europe. That gets a lot of attention, certainly in Europe, also in the United States. Some of his kind of more anti-communist, you know, anti-Soviet statements, leaving Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history in 1982, certainly the Evil Empire speech in March 1983, which was just a few weeks before he unveiled SDI, that gets a lot of attention. And again, you know, kind of reinforces concerns for Americans and West Europeans. What if the superpowers are actually moving towards a nuclear conflict? Certainly the movie The Day After, the ABC television movie that was shown in late 1983 that depicts, you know, a nuclear conflict and its kind of its impact in Lawrence, Kansas. This you know, had like record viewership for Americans. And certainly anti-nuclear activists in the U.S. tried to use that to their advantage and tried to use that as a mobilizing tool to get people who ordinarily didn't want to think about nuclear issues, but who may have seen this movie and been troubled by it, try to pull them into the freeze movement, pull them into activism. So certainly The Day After was huge in terms of getting people to think about, like, what would nuclear war actually look like? Are we heading in that direction?
Right. And the graphics may seem quaint now, but
right.
Back in 1983.
Yes.
Quite phenomenal. So let's move forward a little bit into the meat of your book, into the argument of the book, into really the intervention of your book, or one of the many interventions of your book. Something you do that's different. We hear a lot about nowadays from historians of the era about the anti-nuclear movement.
Yes.
And then historians of human rights tell us a lot about the movement for human rights.
Yes.
And the Helsinki network and process. So far as I'm aware, this is the first book that really puts those two in conversation, brings them together in kind of a unified field of understanding about human rights and anti-nuclear anxieties, combined into a really serious political movement. What brought you to that kind of way of thinking, and what are the most important takeaways from that argument for, say, someone teaching a class on the Cold War?
Yeah. So, I mean, what brought me to that is certainly, you know, European activists in this period are promoting this idea of the indivisibility of peace and human rights. So in the 1980s, initially it was East European activists who really championed this idea of the indivisibility of peace and human rights. So they make the case that, you know, only governments who respect the human rights of their citizens will actually work for peace, will actually work for nuclear disarmament on the world stage. And that, you know, if a government's not respecting the rights of its citizens, well, it's not going to respect the rights of other states, you know, on the world stage.
What are some of those groups? What are the names and the kind of leaders of some of those groups?
Sure. So in Czechoslovakia, Charter 77 is, you know, this is a human rights group that certainly is promoting this idea of the indivisibility of peace and human rights in the early 1980s. You know, Freedom and Peace in Poland, which really gets going kind of in the middle of the decade, actually. The Initiative for Peace and Human Rights in East Germany, also promoting this idea that, you know, governments have to respect the rights of their citizens if they're actually going to work for peace, if they're actually going to be trusted, if they're going to work for disarmament on the world stage. But kind of the flip side of that, also these activists are arguing that all people around the world have the right, like the human right, to work for peace and to, you know, mobilize for nuclear disarmament, you know, on the grassroots level. So I show in the book that this is an idea that really takes off in Eastern Europe initially, but through correspondence with activists in Western Europe, you know, primarily peace and anti-nuclear activists, through, you know, meetings with these activists that typically would take place in Eastern Europe, you know, East European dissidents actually convince, you know, many West European anti-nuclear activists that, yes, you know, peace and human rights are fundamentally linked. They are, you know, they are intrinsically interconnected. So we actually see kind of, and even more broadly speaking, we see these East European activists convincing West Europeans that, you know, nuclear disarmament, human rights, breaking down the blocks in Europe, European autonomy from the superpowers, all of these issues are interrelated. And so we see West European activists really kind of broadening their focus in the middle of the decade, you know, 1984, 1985, to now mobilize in support of human rights, in support of eliminating the blocks in Europe, you know, European autonomy alongside traditional kind of nuclear disarmament issues. And I make the case in the book that this, you know, these arguments that European peace activists are making really influence Gorbachev's ideas about a common European home and what that should look like and kind of how that would be achieved.
Well, what about Reagan? Did it influence Reagan's ideas? I mean, he comes to the summits with a kind of four-point agenda, right? And some of the things you're talking about here seem to be on that four-point agenda.
Yes. So human rights is part of the four-point agenda, you know, as is arms control. But in the course of my research, I really found, you know, the arguments that this kind of transnational European peace movement is making about the indivisibility of peace and human rights more influential on Gorbachev, actually, than Reagan. I see kind of Gorbachev borrowing their proposals, borrowing their language a bit more than Reagan was. I think Reagan perhaps had, you know, didn't need to be convinced as much about the importance of human rights in Eastern Europe, obviously, as you know.
He's already sold.
Right.
In that direction.
Yes, right. When he came into office, yes.
Right. Well, it's an interesting question you can bring up here. The suspicion at the time from those, say, supporting Reagan's Peace Through Strength program, mm-hmm. was that Gorbachev was trying to capture the sympathies of the peace movement mm-hmm. that would then undermine the push for modernization, the push mm-hmm. for, let's say, negotiating leverage of Washington and of the West. Is that the view you have, or do you think Gorbachev holds these things more sincerely?
So I think Gorbachev holds these things more sincerely. So in the book, you know, I make the case that Gorbachev comes to power in the Kremlin in March 1985 already with a moral opposition to nuclear weapons, and that he, you know, comes into power wanting to end the Cold War, partly to reduce the risk of nuclear conflict between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. This was something, you know, I think he and Reagan both sincerely shared this fear of the consequences of using nuclear weapons. Like, this would cause enormous loss of life. This would devastate the planet. This was something both of them were genuinely worried about. With the impact of some of these peace movements on Gorbachev, I think really they're kind of helping him sort of flesh out some of the details of his nuclear arms reduction proposals, flesh out the details of what a common European home would look like with pan-European security structures, you know, economic integration, East-West cooperation on humanitarian issues, on environmental issues, helping him think about how that would be achieved, you know, through the Helsinki, revitalized Helsinki process. But I do think, you know, both Reagan and Gorbachev did sincerely want nuclear disarmament. It wasn't the activists that were making either one of them nuclear abolitionists, to be clear. And to be clear, I should say, when I use the term nuclear abolitionist in this book, I'm using it to refer not only to grassroots anti-nuclear activists, but also to Reagan and Gorbachev, who I say came into power, both of them, with a sincere desire for disarmament.
And it's a very important kind of distinction to make,
right? Yes.
Because the term nuclear abolition has traditionally been attached to that peace movement that
right.
we've been talking about here a little bit. So I want to actually focus in on an episode that you have in the book.
Okay.
That was also written about by our friend Susie Colburn, who came and did a podcast on our sister podcast on her book. And I also wrote about in my book.
Okay.
It's Cap Weinberger at Oxford.
Okay, yes.
What a kind of weird setting for a sitting Secretary of Defense to show up in the first time, right?
Yes.
Give me the background on that debate, how you read that debate, how you read that whole event coming out and really kind of encapsulating the tension of the period.
Right. So you have Cap Weinberger debating E.P. Thompson at Oxford.
Who's E.P. Thompson?
E.P. Thompson is a critical leader of the European anti-nuclear movement. So he was basically the primary author of the Appeal for European Nuclear Disarmament, which was published in April 1980 and really launched this European nuclear disarmament movement, which is one of the key movements I focus on in the book. You know, that ultimately launches these transnational European nuclear disarmament conventions that take place every summer, trying to bring people from East and West together. But they're debating, I believe it's, is there any fundamental difference between or moral difference between the foreign policies of the United States and the Soviet Union?
Yes.
If I'm remembering this correctly, yes. And I use this vignette to open, one of the chapters in my book. And I think, I mean, it's amazing to kind of watch this. You know, you can actually like go on YouTube and watch coverage of this debate. And I think, I mean, on the one hand, it shows that like the Reagan administration really is paying attention to peace activism and paying attention to anti-nuclear sentiment in Western Europe. I mean, certainly at this point, there was a concern, the United States is trying to deploy these new Pershing II and ground-launched cruise missiles in Western Europe at the end of 1983. And there's a fear that these burgeoning anti-nuclear movements, burgeoning anti-nuclear sentiment is going to derail these deployments, which Reagan thinks is crucial to get the Soviets to be serious about intermediate range nuclear force, reductions and negotiations. So certainly, you know, Cap Weinberger debating someone like E.P. Thompson, I think shows the Reagan administration, the highest levels of the Reagan administration are paying attention to these peace activists. This is a real concern. Public opinion, public sentiment, activism in Europe really matters to the Reagan administration.
And the question of morality.
Yeah.
Right. And that the Reagan administration sees themselves as singularly a moral good, mm-hmm. a positive moral force in the world.
Right.
And the Soviet Union is singularly mm-hmm. amoral and evil.
Right.
So the proposition that they're actually on the same moral plane mm-hmm. is altogether remarkable and something that I think has a kind of a lasting relevance for how the U.S. how U.S. power is evaluated and judged mm-hmm. in comparison to its global rivals. Okay, well, there's a lot to get through in this book, so I want to push forward again and again. Something I like to ask our authors: what most surprised you when you're researching this book? You're going through all those archives, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, United States. You know, what really kind of pushed your back and made you rethink your approach to the story you're trying to tell here?
Yeah. So I think, you know, as I was doing the research, what probably surprised me the most was just how kind of global and diverse this phenomenon of nuclear abolitionism was in the 1980s. So I will say that I initially came to this topic, you know, through the American side. So my initial interest was on Reagan and U.S. nuclear freeze activists, kind of their relationship with one another, the policy influence that that had. But as I started doing research for the book, you know, I quickly realized that you can't really do justice to this story of nuclear abolitionism in the 1980s, you know, unless you make this an international story. There are mass anti-nuclear movements, not only in the United States, but in Western Europe. You know, some of these, we've already talked a bit about these human rights groups in Eastern Europe, who previously had really focused on human rights, freedom, and democracy. They start pushing for nuclear disarmament in the 1980s. All of these different grassroots groups are trying to connect with one another, you know, trying to be in contact, kind of forming these transnational ties. And that's just what's going on at the grassroots level, you know, in this period. At the same time, you know, you really see this is a diverse phenomenon. I mean, nuclear abolitionism is really making for strange bedfellows in the 1980s. You know, it's bringing together adversaries, essentially, who share this dream of a world without nuclear weapons, but disagree on many other issues, sometimes like nearly all other issues. You know, certainly you see this, Gorbachev and Eastern Bloc peace activists have different views on the viability of socialism, different views on human rights, but they have this common aim of nuclear disarmament. You know, we've already talked a bit about Reagan and the US and West European anti-nuclear activists. They share a dream of a nuclear free world, but have very different strategies, very different timetables as well, for how to achieve, you know, a world without nuclear weapons. And so I think for me, doing the research and writing this book, it was interesting to see these kind of surprising and very unusual coalitions of protesters and political leaders, you know, coming together around this goal of getting rid of nuclear weapons.
I want to tell you what surprised me.
Okay. I'd be interested to hear it.
It's the juxtaposition you have between Reagan and Bush.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Too many of us, and I'm one of them, guilty, kind of decide to end the Cold War nuclear arms story with the Reagan presidency.
Okay. Yes.
And you smartly carry it through the Bush years.
Into 1989. Yes. Yes.
And the way you put it, though, is it seems like Bush missed an opportunity.
Yes.
And Bush missed an opportunity because he thought about these things differently than Ronald Reagan. Can you shed some light on why he missed that opportunity, how his thinking varied from Reagan? What's the significance there?
Yeah, so this is a key argument I make in the last chapter of this book, is that, you know, Bush bears primary responsibility for a real missed opportunity to see much more dramatic nuclear arms reduction as the Cold War came to an end in 1989. I mean, Bush obviously had been Reagan's vice president for 8 years, but Bush was not a nuclear abolitionist. So this was a key difference with Reagan. Bush also, you know, when he entered the presidency in January 1989, you know, he surrounded himself with top advisors who also were not nuclear abolitionists. Bush, you know, he viewed nuclear weapons really as essential, as an essential way to compensate for Soviet conventional superiority. So certainly Bush was in no hurry to achieve any kind of nuclear disarmament agreement with the Soviet Union in 1989. You know, Bush initially came into office and embarks on this series of comprehensive reviews, even though he had been vice president for 8 years. He wants to review U.S. arms control policy and U.S. defense policy.
A classic delay tactic, right?
Basically.
Review. Okay.
And it works. I mean, essentially, you know, he basically grinds U.S.-Soviet relations to a halt with these reviews, because he doesn't want to, for example, doesn't want to take major steps in arms control until the reviews are complete. But even after the reviews are complete, you know, the Bush administration repeatedly rejects Gorbachev's proposals for tactical nuclear arms reduction negotiations in 1989. The Bush administration, in my view, not making a real serious effort to come to a START agreement in the Strategic Arms Reduction Agreement in 1989. So I do think that Bush, you know, bears responsibility for this missed opportunity to see more sweeping nuclear arms reduction in 1989, which is certainly something that I think Gorbachev was really serious about and trying to work with Bush on, but Bush just not interested in it in 1989, not quite willing to trust Gorbachev was for real at that point.
Which is kind of fascinating in some ways, because it seems that many in the American public were thinking of Bush as a Reagan third term.
Right, yes.
And this is a stark difference. Mm-hmm. He goes about managing the area in which presidents really do have the most room for maneuver, and that's foreign affairs.
Right.
Very interesting there. Let's get into the role of Congress.
Okay.
Because so often we historians write about American political history and somehow Congress gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
They're reacting to presidential initiatives. They're really kind of always the secondary character, unless it's explicitly a history of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But you do a good job of giving Congress its due here. How do you see Congress playing a role in all these abolition debates?
Yeah, so certainly Congress plays a key role in the first part of the book. I mean, so, you know, anti-nuclear activists in the United States are really trying to put pressure on the Reagan administration in a number of different ways. And one way is through Congress, is trying to push Congress to pass a nuclear freeze resolution, which the House of Representatives does do in May 1983. Also, there's a lot of activism trying to push Congress, you know, not to fund various elements of Reagan's nuclear modernization programs. There's a lot of activism around funding for the MX missile in particular. And this does have an effect on Reagan and his team. Certainly, you know, Reagan becomes concerned, you know, what if these activists succeed? And what if Congress, you know, buys into their arguments and will not appropriate money for the strength part of the peace through strength disarmament strategy? And so this, you know, this is kind of part of the way that activists are able to accelerate Reagan administration's, you know, timetable for beginning INF and START talks, you know, get the Reagan administration to make some changes to U.S. INF and START proposals to try to make them more acceptable to the Soviet Union. Also, again, you know, pushing Reagan to unveil the Strategic Defense Initiative. Certainly, you know, Congress is a key vehicle through which activists are putting pressure on the Reagan administration and, you know, getting results and ultimately shaping U.S. arms control policy.
All right. Well, I mean, that's well put. Now, I'd like to wrap with a few kind of more philosophical questions about the meaning of your work.
Okay.
The meaning of the work you do today. What can other historians do? And what's the mm-hmm. long-term impact? So first, tell me, what is the long-term impact, really, of these events in the 1980s?
Yeah, so I mean, the kind of overarching argument I'm making in the book is that nuclear abolitionists played a significant yet unappreciated role in ending the Cold War. And certainly I think, you know, most of us would agree that the end of the Cold War was a key achievement. You know, I think that kind of nuclear abolitionists, their role in the end of the Cold War has sort of been neglected because they were not successful in eliminating nuclear weapons. But they did, you know, they did, I say in the book, have a key role in bringing the Cold War to an end.
I think there's one person out there in the world who's pretty famously on record as saying the end of the Cold War was the greatest geopolitical disaster.
Right. Yeah.
And he might be shaping world events in a
right.
favorable manner right now. Although I think it's no surprise that the Reagan Institute isn't a friend of Putin. So I don't think I'll get in trouble for making that allusion. You're now at the Office of the Historian.
Yes.
In the U.S. Department of State.
Yes.
Certainly many historians know the Office of the Historian exists.
Yes.
But they probably don't know what a day-to-day looks like. What does a historian do at the U.S. Department of State? I think we're all happy to hear that historians have some say in U.S. foreign policy, given how much we study it.
Yes.
But can you give me a little kind of view into the daily life of someone in the Office of the Historian?
Sure. So, I mean, our office works on a number of different things. You know, we produce the Foreign Relations of the United States series, the kind of official documentary history of U.S. foreign policy and key U.S. foreign policy decisions. I actually, though, work in the Historical Studies Division. So we do policy supportive research for officials in the Department of State. So we are, you know, responding to requests from desk officers, from assistant secretaries, you know, from seventh floor principals, from special envoys, really from anyone, and trying to provide them with the historical context, historical background, you know, historical case studies that they want, that they need to make U.S. foreign policy. So every day is a little bit different. You kind of never know what requests are going to come your way and sort of how quickly you're going to have to turn the requests around. So it really, it keeps you on your toes. But certainly has, you know, for me has been a dream job as a historian to get to spend all of my time doing research and writing and trying to support the people in the State Department who are, you know, implementing our foreign policy.
No doubt the best policies coming out of the Department of State have made use of the historians on staff. I'm sure that's how it works, right? If you did a study on that. Well, let's wrap with this question I always like to ask all of our guests. What is the area of history that you want to see more people focused on? What is that topic, that thing that while you're really waiting for the next great study or in writing your book, mm-hmm. what are the things that you missed or that you couldn't possibly cover? Because, you know, the publisher only says you have this many words.
Right.
You should take up the baton and carry it forward.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts in my book, certainly, as I've said, because nuclear abolitionism was a diverse and global phenomenon in the 1980s. You know, there was no way that I could possibly cover, you know, all of even grassroots anti-nuclear groups in the 1980s. Certainly, there were thriving, you know, anti-nuclear movements in the Pacific, you know, in New Zealand. I think there's definitely still a story to tell about, you know, some of that. I really had, you know, focused on the United States, Europe, and the Soviet Union in my work, trying to figure out how nuclear abolitionists played into the end of the Cold War. But certainly thinking about, you know, anti-nuclearism in the Pacific, I think there's good work to be done on that. You know, I think I feel like we're seeing a trend more in the field where we see folks trying to link, you know, what's happening at the grassroots level to high-level policymaking. Certainly that was my aim with this book here. And I think there's more work to be done kind of more generally, not just on nuclear arms control issues, trying to show how ordinary people can shape U.S. foreign policy, you know, can shape these big issues. And so certainly I think there's work to be done there.
Oh, that's a nice note to end on.
All right.
That people do matter.
People do matter. I hope that's one of the takeaways from my book. I hope so.
Well, Stephanie, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of Rendezvous with History. And I hope all of our listeners have a rendezvous with your book.
Thank you.
Dreams for a Decade. Make sure to buy it on Amazon or University Penn's website.
Yes.
Or any other places you might buy your book. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rendezvous with History is a podcast produced by the Ronald Reagan Institute's scholarly initiatives. You can learn more at ronaldreaganinstitute.org and follow along on social media at Reagan Institute.